It is increasingly appearing inevitable that another major war is about to explode in the Middle East. That could see Israel launching another major ground invasion of a neighboring country, this time to the north into Lebanon. In the span of just a couple weeks between the 17th and 18th of September, the entire mood along the Israel-Lebanon border shifted sharply from a low-intensity simmering conflict that had been going on for a year to that of a major-intensity conflict that increasingly risked spiraling into a devastating all-out war. It began on the 17th of September, when the Israeli Security Cabinet officially expanded Israel's war objectives to include the safe return of the around 60,000 Israeli civilians who had been evacuated from a strip of land in northern Israel along the border with Lebanon. The area was ordered to be evacuated by the Israeli government shortly after the Hamas attacks on Israel on October 7th of 2023. When Hamas's ally, Hezbollah, based just across the border in Lebanon, almost immediately began firing rockets and missiles into northern Israel in a declared solidarity with Hamas. Hezbollah's nearly three decades-long leader, Hassan Nasrallah, continually said that his organization would continue firing rockets into Israel until a ceasefire was made in Gaza and until Israeli forces withdrew from the territory. And since then, over the roughly 12 months that followed, without an end to the Gaza war in sight up until mid-September of 2024, Hezbollah fired around 8,000 rockets into northern Israel. That resulted in the deaths of 26 Israeli soldiers and security officers and 27 Israeli civilians, along with the evacuation of around 60,000 Israelis from the north that remain internally displaced across the country. At the same time, Israeli forces also repeatedly bombed and attacked targets across southern Lebanon over the roughly 12 months that followed October 7th as well, that resulted in the deaths of an estimated 500 or so members of Hezbollah and around 150 Lebanese civilians prior to September 17th, and that also resulted in around 110,000 Lebanese civilians fleeing from the south and getting internally displaced across Lebanon. Israel and Hezbollah were therefore already fighting a low-scale, low-intensity, simmering war against the other for nearly a year up until the 17th of September, when Israel formally added the safe return of all of its 60,000 citizens back to their homes in the north as a formal war goal. That also included eliminating Hezbollah's capacity to continue firing rockets into the north that have so far prevented their return for nearly the whole of the past year. And almost immediately as the declaration was being made, Israel decided to begin rapidly escalating its nearly year-long simmering war with Hezbollah into something much more confrontational. The same day as the new war goal was announced, thousands of small, handheld pagers belonging to Hezbollah members that they used for communications exploded almost simultaneously across Lebanon and Syria in a devastating surprise attack. And then the very next day, hundreds of handheld radios belonging to Hezbollah simultaneously exploded as well in another devastating surprise attack. The combined back-to-back Hezbollah-owned pager and radio explosions killed at least 42 people and wounded around 3,500 others, including many civilians, and wreaked absolute chaos within Hezbollah's ranks as an organization. Most of the members of Hezbollah carrying the pagers were considered higher-ranking members of the group, and scores of them have been left severely injured and crippled with lifelong debilitating injuries that will prevent their ability to fight in the future. On top of that, Hezbollah as an organization was profoundly and perhaps irrecoverably embarrassed by the operation, with a level of Israeli intelligence penetration into their organization much higher than seemingly anybody suspected. Somehow, when Hezbollah began acquiring the pagers around 5 months before the attack, the Israelis managed to covertly implant thousands of them with miniature remote-controlled explosives without anybody in Hezbollah noticing until it was too late, implying that Hezbollah has a catastrophic spy problem within their ranks that will be difficult for them to root out, and that'll reduce trust in them as an organization going forward. And at the same time, with the destruction of all their pagers and radios and with the previous Israeli penetration into their cell networks, the attack has severely crippled Hezbollah's communications network as well. With this loss of faith in technology and no remaining reliable communication network to rely upon for a military response to a war, Hezbollah's only remaining method of communication in the wake of the pager and radio attacks were effectively verbal and written communications, which it relied upon for a rapid in-person meeting between several high-ranking commanders only a couple days later on the 20th of September in an apartment building in the southern Beirut suburb of Dahiya. which Israeli intelligence also somehow knew about because the Israeli Air Force bombed that apartment building as the meeting was taking place, eliminating the top commander of Hezbollah's elite Radwan force, basically Hezbollah's most elite special forces wing, all with around 10 other high-ranking Hezbollah officers in the process, crippling even more of Hezbollah's leadership structure. In the midst of all these attacks, Hassan Nasrallah, Hezbollah's ultimate top leader, declared during his speech on the 19th of September that the Israeli pager and radio attacks amounted to nothing less than an Israeli declaration of war against Lebanon, and that while the attacks had dealt Hezbollah a great blow, he also swore that so long as the Gaza war continues, Hezbollah would continue firing rockets into Israel and would prevent the 60,000 Israeli citizens from returning back to their homes in the north. Then on the 22nd of September, just a few days later, Hezbollah fired around 115 rockets into Israel again, with many aimed at the major Israeli city of Haifa, representing the furthest distance into Israeli territory that Hezbollah had so far fired rockets into since the conflict began. Then, after nearly all of them were shot down by Israel's air defenses without causing any casualties, the Israelis carried out an unprecedentedly massive airstrike campaign across Hezbollah strongholds in southern and eastern Lebanon the following day on the 23rd of September that they said targeted Hezbollah military positions and infrastructure. The Israeli military reported that these airstrikes that targeted around 1,300 locations across Lebanon destroyed thousands of Hezbollah-owned rockets and missiles, potentially as many as 50% of Hezbollah's total rocket and missile arsenal, according to some Israeli sources, which, if accurate, will of course further degrade Hezbollah's capabilities to continue firing rockets into Israel. While the Lebanese health ministry reported that the attacks on this single day killed more than 550 people in the country and wounded more than 1,800 others, without specifying exactly how many of those casualties were Hezbollah combatants and civilians. But either way, it marked the deadliest single day in Lebanon's entire history since the end of their civil war in 1990. And it also represented nearly half of all the deaths that Lebanon suffered during the 34-day war that they fought against Israel back in 2006, all representing a major escalation in the intensity of the current conflict between Israel and Hezbollah, all as tens of thousands of additional Lebanese civilians fled the heavy bombardment of southern Lebanon for their lives to the perceived safety of the capital Beirut, further up to the north. As all of these attacks were just getting started on the 18th of September, Israel's Defense Minister Yoav Gallant declared to Israeli soldiers that a new phase of the war on Gaza had begun, with a new focus on the northern front with Hezbollah, as he announced the redeployment of the Israeli 98th Paratroopers Division to the border with Lebanon, that consists of between 10,000 and 20,000 troops, which joins the previously deployed four Israeli brigades on the border that consisted of between 12,000 and 20,000 other troops, and more have continued massing on the border over the days that have followed. Days later, on the 22nd of September, Israel's Prime Minister Benjamin Netanyahu vowed that Israel would take whatever action is necessary in order to return its 60,000 civilians to their homes in the north. While on the 25th of September, the IDF's Chief of Staff, General Herzi Halevi, told Israeli forces participating in a drill in the north near the border with Lebanon that the previous Israeli airstrikes targeted against Hezbollah were intended, quote, to prepare the area for the possibility of your entry, directly hinting at the possibility of a looming Israeli ground invasion into southern Lebanon. And then on the 27th of September, the Israeli military took the most fateful decision it has probably made in decades. They decided to launch an attack designed to assassinate the longtime leader of Hezbollah himself, Hassan Nasrallah. Forced to rely on in-person communications with all of their other communication systems destroyed or infiltrated, the Israelis learned that Nasrallah, along with several other high-ranking Hezbollah officers, were gathering together for a high-level meeting within their central headquarters buried beneath the ground in southern Beirut. A headquarters placed directly beneath several apartment buildings above ground, inhabited by large numbers of civilians. Regardless, the Israeli Air Force decided to launch a massive bombing raid against the headquarters as the meeting was taking place, dropping dozens of highly advanced bunker-busting bombs on the area at once that obliterated the entire city block of apartment buildings and Hezbollah's headquarters beneath it. The attack almost certainly claimed the lives of hundreds of people, including huge numbers of both Hezbollah members and officers, as well as civilians. And it most notably resulted in the elimination of Hassan Nasrallah himself, leaving Hezbollah a temporarily leaderless organization on top of all of its other mounting issues. Rapidly afterwards, fearful of Hezbollah's potential to initiate a massive retaliatory strike on Israel for the assassination of their top leader and countless other officers, the Israeli Air Force began carrying out additional major bombing strikes across Lebanon directed at Hezbollah's known remaining rocket and missile arsenal storage sites, with the goal of racing against the clock to eliminate as many of them as possible before they could be used. And now, the entire world is bracing for how Hezbollah and their primary patron, Iran, will decide on responding to all of this. As recently as just a month ago, Hezbollah was widely feared as the most formidable and competent enemy that Israel had supposedly ever faced. And that entire perception was seemingly destroyed in only a matter of weeks. In less than 2 weeks, Israel completely destroyed and dismantled Hezbollah's communications networks, knocked out thousands of rank-and-file Hezbollah soldiers with crippling, lifelong injuries, destroyed huge numbers of Hezbollah's feared rocket and missile arsenal, and virtually annihilated nearly all of Hezbollah's top leadership, culminating with the assassination of their nearly three-decade-long serving general secretary, Hassan Nasrallah himself. And all with barely a response from either Hezbollah or Iran at all, at least so far. Indeed, Hezbollah has probably been so profoundly shocked by these heavy blows over the past 2 weeks that they may simply be incapable of responding or retaliating in any significant way very quickly, and they will need an extensive amount of time to regroup and reorganize themselves with new leadership, new communications, and new weapons. As a result, Israel has potentially opened itself up a narrow window of opportunity to invade southern Lebanon with ground forces to push Hezbollah's forces in the area back away from the border by force, while they are at their most stunned, disorganized, and weakened moment, before they can have the time to rebuild and regroup. And even though a full-scale ground invasion into southern Lebanon may not be desirable, it might still end up becoming inevitable from the Israeli perspective anyway, in order for them to guarantee, once and for all, that Hezbollah's capability to continue firing rockets into Israel is ended for good. Because just on the 25th of September, even after all of the punishing Israeli attacks on them over the week beforehand, Hezbollah still managed to fire a ballistic missile aimed directly at Tel Aviv anyway. Israel's largest city, and the first time that Hezbollah had ever directly targeted the city with an attack. And even though this single missile was shot down by Israel's air defenses, it still sent a clear message that Hezbollah's capability to continue attacking Israeli cities, including Tel Aviv, remained intact to an unknown extent, giving good reason for any potential Israeli ground invasion into Lebanon to pause and contemplate the potential consequences. You see, ever since October 8th of 2023, when Hezbollah began firing rockets into northern Israel and forced the evacuation of tens of thousands of Israelis from the border, Hezbollah has achieved something that they had never managed to do beforehand. They shifted the buffer zone between themselves and Israel from southern Lebanon, where it had been for decades, deeper into northern Israel instead. A huge and unprecedented victory from their perspective, while also tying up thousands of Israeli soldiers and missile defense batteries in the north that couldn't be deployed to the fight against Hamas in Gaza to boot. For most of the past year, Israel was hesitant to directly engage Hezbollah over the issue, out of fear of escalating the situation into another full-blown war at the same time they were still actively fighting Hamas in Gaza, and thus forcing themselves into an unpredictable and dangerous two-front war in the process. But also over this past year, as Hamas's military capabilities in Gaza have been steadily degraded, and as much of Gaza itself has been reduced to a pile of rubble under increasingly tight Israeli occupation, Israel's appetite for escalation on other fronts has begun to increase. When the Israeli attacks on Hezbollah began to rapidly escalate with the pager and radio attacks on the 17th and 18th of September, Israel essentially entered into a very high-stakes gamble where they believed they could inflict enough pain and pressure on Hezbollah to force them into doing what they want without escalating the situation all the way to full-scale warfare and a ground invasion. Seen from the Israeli perspective, it has all essentially been an escalate-to-de-escalate kind of a situation, with the hope that by hurting Hezbollah's capabilities enough and by causing them enough damage, they can compel them to back down without them deciding to escalate things any further towards a total war that could result in their total annihilation. Israel's leaders hope that with increasing pressure and pain, Hezbollah will eventually agree to a separate ceasefire irrespective of what happens in Gaza, agree to pull themselves back away from the border, and agree to allow the 60,000 or so Israelis to return back to their homes in the north again safely. But Hezbollah, while badly bloodied over the past several weeks, is still an extremely well-armed and now extremely angry and vengeful organization whose leadership, though decimated, has so far still remained completely resolute through all of the pain that they will, no matter what happens, continue to fire missiles and rockets into Israel so long as the war in Gaza continues without a ceasefire. And with neither Israel nor Hamas appearing willing to compromise on a ceasefire agreement there in Gaza, it appears that Israel and Hezbollah are currently playing one of the highest stakes games of chicken in recent memory, where the end stage is appearing increasingly likely to be a full-out Israeli invasion of southern Lebanon, as airstrikes and covert pager explosions alone seem that they will not be enough to pressure Hezbollah to end its rocket campaign, absent a ceasefire in Gaza. Historically, over the past year of conflict here, both sides between Israel and Hezbollah have been reluctant to escalate the fighting towards full-scale war for a plethora of reasons. Hezbollah was seemingly content with only engaging the Israelis in a limited conflict, tying up some of their resources in the north, without escalating to a full-blown war that they know Lebanon as a country can ill afford. You see, over the past 5 years since 2019, Lebanon has undergone what many economists have referred to as one of the greatest economic collapses in all of modern history since the Industrial Revolution. It began with an unprecedented liquidity crisis in Lebanese banks that started over the summer of 2019, and then gradually escalated with a cascading series of once-in-a-generation catastrophes that all had the misfortune of basically striking all at once. Starting with the onset of the COVID-19 pandemic in 2020, then got even worse with the economic fallout from Beirut's infamous port explosion that caused billions of dollars in property damage, then got even worse with the Russian invasion of Ukraine that severely disrupted Lebanon's imports of grain, and then still somehow got even worse with the onset of the Israel-Hezbollah shooting war that started in October of 2023. Because of all of this, since 2019, the Lebanese currency has lost a whopping 98% of its value, while the country's GDP has crashed by more than half. While the national inflation rate skyrocketed to more than 221% by 2023, and has remained in the triple digits for years now, ever since 2021. Simultaneously, Lebanon's public debt-to-GDP ratio absolutely ballooned to more than 282% by 2022, ranking the country as having literally the highest debt level as a percentage of GDP in the entire world. Even before the current conflict began with Israel in late 2023, the Lebanese economy was teetering on the edge of a full-scale collapse, and entering into a major war with Israel would probably result in the country falling off the cliff entirely into the abyss. Hezbollah and Lebanon have each watched on over the past year as the Israeli Air Force has relentlessly bombarded the Gaza Strip into a veritable pile of rubble. While for several years now, numerous Israeli military officials have warned that a full-scale war with Hezbollah would include the Israeli Air Force obliterating Lebanon's civilian infrastructure as well, in the hope of turning the Lebanese population against Hezbollah. Such an action, with Lebanon's already precarious economic situation, would be impossible for the struggling country to afford to rebuild on its own, and would probably push the country over into the status of a failed state like neighboring Syria. And as a major political party within Lebanon that actively participates in the Lebanese government, that's a situation that Hezbollah and the Lebanese people can ill afford. Moreover, Hezbollah's top supporter for years has always been Iran, who, over the past 18 years since Hezbollah's last war with Israel, has provided billions of dollars worth of increasingly advanced rockets and missiles to the group, including many highly valuable precision-guided long-range missiles that Hezbollah has so far largely kept in reserve. Both the CIA and the Center for Strategic and International Studies have each variously estimated that immediately before the current conflict with Israel, Hezbollah was in possession of an arsenal that included around 150,000 rockets and missiles of various different types, mostly supplied to them by Iran, which made Hezbollah the most heavily armed non-state actor in the world. To the Iranians, this arsenal of rockets and missiles provided to Hezbollah became one of their greatest ever insurance policies against a potential Israeli or American attack on their nuclear research facilities. Because if they were to do that, Iran could always just give Hezbollah the green light to unleash that arsenal upon Israel's cities. An enormous volume of fire that would stand to potentially overwhelm Israel's air defenses and cause massive damage. And Iran would be loath to lose this insurance policy because without it, there wouldn't really be much else standing in the way of an Israeli or American attack on their nuclear research facilities, which encourages the Iranians to pressure Hezbollah into at least an amount of restraint in their fight against Israel, on top of Hezbollah's own desire for restraint so as not to plunge Lebanon into an irreversible collapse scenario. And these fears of escalation also extended into the Israeli perspective as well. Ever since the last war between Israel and Hezbollah concluded in 2006, both sides have spent the past 18 years methodically preparing themselves for the next war. And Israel has long been aware that Hezbollah is a far, far greater threat than Hamas has been in Gaza. The Center for Strategic and International Studies estimated immediately before the current war that Hezbollah had around 30,000 active-duty armed fighters and another 20,000 more in their reserves that could be rapidly called up in the event of an emergency, which closely matches the CIA's estimate of Hezbollah possessing around 50,000 armed members within its ranks as well, which is also roughly equivalent to the numbers of personnel within the Lebanese government's own military. And in addition, Hezbollah's massive arsenal of rockets and missiles that far exceeds anything the Lebanese government itself has, the group has enormous amounts of machine guns, RPGs, heavy artillery pieces, and even tanks, and is more of a highly trained conventional military utilized by a state rather than a mere militia. And thousands of its soldiers have extensive and recent combat experience from fighting in the Syrian civil war on the side of the Bashar al-Assad regime. Hezbollah's military wing is so powerful and well-armed that it's most often considered to be even more powerful and capable than the Lebanese military itself is. And unlike Hamas in Gaza that is completely encircled by the Israelis, Hezbollah's position in Lebanon can be much more easily resupplied directly from Iran in the event of a full-scale war, through well-established land and air routes across friendly allied territory in Iraq and Syria. Israel has known for a long time that a full-scale war against Hezbollah would be a much more challenging and costly fight than its ongoing war against Hamas has been, and the damage that Hezbollah could potentially inflict on Israel's own infrastructure and cities with all of its rockets and missiles could be catastrophic if all fired at once, giving Israel a high incentive to be cautious as well. But some other Israeli incentives to be cautious have been steadily eroding with time. The IDF now occupies large swaths of Gaza, and Hamas's military capabilities, while not completely destroyed, have been severely degraded, giving Israel the recent possibility of greater flexibility to devote greater resources to other pressing fronts like Lebanon. At the same time, the Israeli military leadership and the country's prime minister, Benjamin Netanyahu, are increasingly eager to gamble in order to score a military victory that they can sell to the Israeli people. It's no secret that the war in Gaza, going on a full 1 year of length now, has devolved into a costly and expensive quagmire with Hamas still unwilling to accept final defeat, and with around 100 Israeli hostages still being held by them. Netanyahu's promise of ultimate victory over Hamas 1 year in has still proven elusive, while his popularity continues to waver. Netanyahu himself also still faces numerous domestic threats within Israel to his continued political leadership, including multiple ongoing corruption trials, demands from many ultra-Orthodox members of his own coalition government to revoke a new controversial military draft law that requires ultra-Orthodox Israeli Jews to serve in the military, in addition to a looming government inquiry that will eventually call him to answer and testify for how Hamas's October 7th attack was able to break through Israeli security. Some analysts have even speculated that the moment the current war is over, Netanyahu's long political career in Israel will likely end alongside it. With a poll conducted by Israel's Channel 12 News as recently as August of 2024, that showed a whopping 69% of Israelis believe Netanyahu should resign from his office and not seek re-election. From Netanyahu's own personal perspective, then, the longer he can continue the state of war towards some kind of victory, the better his personal political prospects could become in the future, since they're already basically hopeless. In short, he doesn't really have anything left to lose personally by gambling and continuing or escalating the current war towards an outcome that might look better for him in the end. So for both him and the Israeli military, who have each failed to destroy Hamas and failed to free all of the hostages in Gaza after a year of full-scale war there, delivering a different victory on another front in Lebanon against Hezbollah is a gamble they suddenly appeared willing to roll the iron dice for in September. But the gamble rests on their assumption that Hezbollah, badly humbled by Israel's week of heavy attacks, will simply cave into the pressure and do what they want. Indeed, Hezbollah now has significantly less ability to respond to Israeli escalation than they did before the pager and radio attacks, and all of the airstrikes that followed it for three key reasons. With their communications network destroyed and compromised, they will struggle to coordinate any kind of effective military response. With so many of their top leadership killed or severely injured over the past few weeks of attacks, including their longtime top leader, their leadership structure is likely crippled and paralyzed on top of their battlefield communications being crippled. While their third issue is that they still haven't really figured out exactly how deep Israeli intelligence has managed to infiltrate them. Hezbollah will need to spend a great deal of time reorganizing itself and finding new leadership, inspecting the remaining equipment for potential Israeli sabotage and rooting out any spies within their ranks. Not to mention replacing the likely thousands of rockets they've lost to all of the recent Israeli airstrikes as well. Hezbollah is now in the weakest possible position they've ever been in probably their entire history to adequately confront Israel. And Israel knows it and will continue trying to mount pressure in the hope that Hezbollah eventually cracks and agree to withdraw away from the border in a separate ceasefire from Gaza without a full-scale war exploding. But this is probably unlikely to happen because there are many, many diplomatic hurdles standing in the way of that from actually taking place. Hezbollah's entire identity and the whole reason why it was founded in the first place back in the 1980s was to militantly resist Israel's presence in Lebanon, after Israel invaded the country the first time in 1982 in the middle of the devastating Lebanese Civil War, in order to try and root out Palestinian militants from the country who had established themselves in Beirut and launched multiple raids across the border into Israeli territory. Between 1983 and 1985, the Israelis began withdrawing from most of Lebanon, but they retained their control over a strip of land in the south of the country that they simply referred to as the Security Zone, a militarily occupied buffer zone within Lebanon that the Israeli military for years argued was necessary to protect Israeli citizens from further raids by terrorist organizations based in Lebanon. The Security Zone comprised about 10% of Lebanon's total territory, and about 6% of Lebanon's total population, or around 180,000 people. And the Israelis continued occupying the area even after the chaotic Lebanese Civil War ended in 1990. They remained in place in the Security Zone in southern Lebanon for another decade until the year 2000, when Israeli forces finally withdrew from the Security Zone back to Israel after it was determined that it was costing too many Israeli soldiers' lives to maintain and wasn't making Israel any safer. Hezbollah was born as a Shiite militia organization out of southern and eastern Lebanon's own Shia Muslim communities during this time period in the 1980s to resist Israel's continued occupation of southern Lebanon. And after the Lebanese Civil War concluded in 1990, all of the country's various militia organizations that had been bloodily fighting against one another for the past decade and a half all agreed to disarm themselves and disband. All of them except for Hezbollah, that is, who managed to carve out an exception for themselves based on the argument that they needed to continue existing in order to liberate southern Lebanon from the Israelis, which remained under occupation. Well, their argument was made all the more convincing by the fact that they were heavily supported by the Iranians and supplied with massive volumes of weapons by them that left Hezbollah in a unique position that was unchallengeable by the secular Lebanese military without causing additional massive bloodshed and a continuation of the civil war. Iran then continued to carefully nurture Hezbollah's position in Lebanon with advisors and billions of dollars worth of weapons over the years that passed. And after Israel managed to assassinate Hezbollah's old leader back in 1992, they merely paved the way within the organization for the rise of Hassan Nasrallah instead, who showed back then that Israel's use of force and assassinations would not destroy Hezbollah as an organization, nor compel it to moderate its stance on militant confrontation with Israel. A lesson that likely remains true still today, even after Israel's final assassination of Nasrallah too. It was under Nasrallah's long leadership that Hezbollah shifted away from a shadowy organization that engaged in tactics like suicide bombings and hostage taking, and towards a new focus on guerrilla warfare and a professional military wing aimed primarily at Israeli military targets, like the security zone that Israel continued to occupy across southern Lebanon throughout the 1990s. After continuous, relentless attacks on the security zone, Nasrallah's Hezbollah managed to convince the Israelis that it was no longer worth maintaining by the year 2000, when the Israelis finally decided on an organized withdrawal from it. And afterwards, Hezbollah began basing their argument for continuing to exist in Lebanon on the supposed need to continue defending southern Lebanon from another Israeli invasion in the future, and to liberate a small area of land here known as the Sheba Farms that Hezbollah and Lebanon each claim is rightfully Lebanese. Now, the overall history of the Sheba Farms is incredibly complicated and outside the scope of this video. But for the sake of brevity, Israel came to occupy the territory as a part of the Golan Heights they seized from Syria in the Six-Day War of 1967. The Lebanese government, however, has claimed the small Sheba Farms area as a part of their own territory ever since then, based on historical records. While Syria has since agreed with Lebanon's claim to the Sheba Farms, while they continue claiming the rest of the Golan Heights for themselves. While Israel counterclaims that the Sheba Farms territory originally belonged to Syria, but has since been annexed into Israel since 1981, along with the rest of the Golan Heights. Now, because of Lebanon's continued claim to the Sheba Farms, and Israel's continued control of the territory following their withdrawal from the security zone in southern Lebanon after 2000, Hezbollah has argued ever since that Israel's withdrawal from Lebanon has never been completed, since they remain present in the Sheba Farms. And it's been entirely on this rather flimsy premise that Hezbollah has based its entire legal argument for continuing to exist as an armed militia within Lebanon on for the past 24 years. The argument that enables Hezbollah to essentially function as a separate Iranian-backed state within Lebanon, complete with its own separate foreign and defense policies, its own separate better-armed and more powerful army. And most importantly, the capability to throw the entire country into a war with Israel if they decide so, without the need to consult any of the rest of Lebanon. Because of that argument to continue existing within the context of Lebanon, Hezbollah cannot ever just easily consider withdrawing away from the border with Israel, because to do so would cast their entire argument to keep existing in Lebanon into jeopardy. How could Hezbollah truthfully argue that they needed to continue existing in Lebanon and defending the border against Israel if they were located far away from the Sheba Farms and the border? If they did so, somebody within Lebanon would eventually make the case that Hezbollah should finally abide by the treaty that ended the Lebanese Civil War in 1990 and disarm and disband itself like every other Lebanese militia group besides them already did a long time ago. And so, Hezbollah has every incentive to strongly resist pulling away from the border with Israel, even when international law compels it to do so, as has been the case ever since 2006. The last time that Israel and Hezbollah went to war with each other was for 34 days of highly attritional combat back in 2006. After a Hezbollah raid on the border killed 3 Israeli soldiers and took 2 more as prisoners of war that ended in an inconclusive stalemate for both sides, after Israel reinvaded southern Lebanon with a ground invasion again. That war concluded with the United Nations Security Council Resolution 1701, which called for an immediate end in hostilities between both sides, the withdrawal of all Israeli troops from Lebanese territory, the withdrawal of Hezbollah's armed forces to the north of the Litani River within Lebanon, roughly 30 kilometers away from the southern border, and the deployment of the Lebanese army and UN peacekeeping forces to the south of Lebanon between the border with Israel and the Litani River to keep the Israelis and Hezbollah away from each other and to maintain the peace. However, while most sides honored the terms of Resolution 1701, Hezbollah, in the end, never lived up to their end of the treaty and never actually withdrew their forces to the north of the Litani River. Instead, over the past 18 years since then, they dug numerous tunnels from South Lebanon into northern Israel beneath the border,
massively rearmed and reorganized themselves with billions of dollars worth of support from Iran, and dug themselves in across the area south of the Litani River, directly on Israel's border, in open violation of the UN's Resolution 1701. With Iran's extremely heavy external support, Hezbollah continued to remain more powerful than both the Lebanese army itself and the UN peacekeeping force that was deployed to Lebanon, which left them both effectively powerless to actually compel Hezbollah to abide by the resolution and withdraw away from the border. While Resolution 1701 itself contained no punitive measures to actually punish Hezbollah for not really abiding by it.
The only way that the Lebanese army or UN peacekeepers in the country could make Hezbollah withdraw north of the Latani River was by attacking them with force, which would probably have reignited the vicious Lebanese civil war of the 1970s and 80s.
So for nearly two decades ever since, both the UN and the Lebanese government have each been effectively powerless to ever do anything about Hezbollah's continued and building presence on Israel's border.
And now we arrive at why a diplomatic solution between Israel and Hezbollah in the current escalating conflict is going to be extremely difficult, if not even impossible, to arrive at, and why the probable failure of diplomacy will most likely lead to another catastrophic war.
Hezbollah's leadership has sworn over and over again that they will not stop firing rockets and missiles into Israel or consider withdrawing away from the border until the war in Gaza is concluded and Israeli forces withdraw from the territory, which means that Israel's only option for diplomacy with Hezbollah is linked to concluding the war in Gaza, which doesn't seem likely anytime soon. So without ending the war in Gaza, Israel has decided to increase their military escalation against Hezbollah by hitting them much more aggressively in the hope of compelling them to quietly withdraw away from the border and abide by the terms of the UN's Resolution 1701, rather than choosing to escalate things any further. But if Israel escalates the situation too far, such as by blowing up Hezbollah's central headquarters in Beirut, killing their top leadership, and by going after their preciously valuable long-range missiles, a vengeful and furious Hezbollah may be pushed too far into a corner and decide that it would be better to use up all of their remaining missiles in a show of strength rather than lose them, which could ultimately spark the much-feared all-out war between them.
And Hezbollah is very unlikely to just agree on withdrawing their forces and equipment away from the border and north of the Latani River like UN Resolution 1701 demands they do, because to do so would undermine their argument for continuing to exist within Lebanon.
Hezbollah could, in theory, always agree to withdraw away from the border and keep the remaining weapons and just refuse to disarm. But then, if the calls within Lebanon eventually grew loud enough for them to disarm, Hezbollah, now in a severely weakened and humiliated state, may get itself into a situation where it would be forced to turn their weapons against their fellow Lebanese citizens in order to continue existing in the country, which would essentially reveal Hezbollah as more of an Iranian asset than a true protector of Lebanon, with Lebanon's own best interests at heart, and would probably reignite the Lebanese civil war again in the process.
It is impossible for Hezbollah to really function outside of the context of Lebanon, and so Hezbollah needs to at least appear willing to cooperate with Lebanon's political and legal systems in order to maintain its standing within the country's diverse and highly sectarian demographics of Shia Muslims, Sunni Muslims, Christians, and Druze.
And rather than face all of that as a possibility, Hezbollah, even after all of its recent massive setbacks, may still decide on holding its positions on Israel's border as its new leadership decides on how and when to respond to the assassination of Hassan Nasrallah.
And on the other side, Israel is no longer willing to tolerate Hezbollah's long-term dug-in position immediately north of their borders in a post-October 7th world, and is no longer willing to tolerate the permanent displacement of tens of thousands of their citizens from the north. And with no ceasefire anywhere on the horizon in Gaza,
and with neither Hezbollah nor Israel seemingly willing to make any compromises, the direction seems increasingly inevitable towards full-scale war that will involve Israel eventually launching a ground invasion into southern Lebanon again to try and force Hezbollah away from the border at the point of a gun. Israel would then likely try and either set up some kind of new security or buffer zone in southern Lebanon, similar to the one they maintained in the country for years between 1985 and 2000 again, or they would try and create a situation where they would destroy and dismantle Hezbollah's remaining presence south of the Latani River and then withdraw, handing over the area between the river and the border to the Lebanese army and the UN in the aftermath, like the UN's Resolution 1701 originally envisioned back in 2006. From Israel's perspective, absent of diplomacy and absent of compelling Hezbollah to vacate the border by limited escalation, a full-scale ground invasion and reestablishment of some form of a security zone in southern Lebanon may be their only way to create a situation that actually enables their tens of thousands of displaced residents to return back to their homes in the north again. But a full-on ground invasion into southern Lebanon would carry with it enormous risks as well. And it may actually be exactly what Hezbollah wants to happen. Yet another Israeli invasion of southern Lebanon and potential long-term occupation of territory in Lebanon would fundamentally justify Hezbollah's continued argument to exist within Lebanon, and would probably give the group significantly increased legitimacy and volunteers within the country. Something that Hezbollah would probably actually relish after suffering all of its humiliations and reputational damage recently. Not to mention how costly the ground invasion would probably be, both in terms of lives and legitimacy for Israel. Hezbollah would be fighting on its own turf that it knows very well, and the land in southern Lebanon is very rugged and hilly, and full of underground tunnels and built-up fortifications that Hezbollah has constructed over decades, perfectly suiting Hezbollah to wage a tough, guerrilla-style war that could devolve into a long and drawn-out slugfest. Even with the loss of potentially as many as half of their arsenal of rockets and missiles to the Israelis over the past few weeks of attacks, and the assassinations of nearly all of their top leadership, Hezbollah's prized arsenal of strategic long-range missiles likely remains largely intact, which could still potentially be used to cause massive damage to Israeli infrastructure and cities. And if Hezbollah's new leaders decide to unleash whatever of their arsenal remains on Israeli cities, the attack could be devastating enough to trigger the looming Israeli ground invasion. Or the invasion could be launched to preemptively stop it. At the same time, the sight of Israeli jets pulverizing Hezbollah positions in Lebanese cities and infrastructure would mirror the carnage that Israel has already inflicted upon Gaza over the past year, which will probably negatively impact Israel's international perception more than it already has been, and will likely contribute even more to Israel's international isolation that has been growing since the war began, implying that even a tactical Israeli success in southern Lebanon could ultimately still prove to be a strategic failure in the long run. Moreover, Israel would struggle to stop Hezbollah's logistics and resupply lines that connect directly to Iran over land and through airspace across Syria and Iraq. And there's never any guarantee that a ground invasion and occupation into southern Lebanon wouldn't just morph into another long, grinding military quagmire like Gaza has turned into. And even further, would Iran's leaders truly just sit back and watch on as their most valuable proxy force in the region gets itself destroyed and pushed out of Lebanon? If Hezbollah gets practically dismantled or defanged by the Israelis, then Iran loses its most valuable insurance policy against the Israelis or Americans attacking their nuclear research facilities, which means that Iran would be incentivized to heavily intervene if it looked like Hezbollah was on the brink of collapse. Or, if the Iranians feared intervening too heavily, with all of the American forces around them and the concerns about their own infiltration by Israeli intelligence, Iran also could end up deciding to rush through the development of a nuclear weapon as quickly as possible, in order to restore their deterrence and insurance policy before their research sites could be destroyed. Of course, such a decision would be like a catch-22 situation for them. Iran has always relied on Hezbollah's conventional deterrence to protect their nuclear research sites from attack. And so, if the Iranians decided to sprint towards a nuclear bomb due to losing Hezbollah, their nuclear research sites would be open to a window of attack, which would almost certainly provoke Israeli and American airstrikes on them anyway. Which is why Iran is treading very carefully here and calculating on what kind of a response to actually commit to. No matter what decision Iran or Hezbollah take, it is going to have bad consequences for them. They either look extremely weak and incompetent if they do nothing, or they face unpredictable and dangerous escalation that could result in even more damage for them by responding. The entire border between Israel and Lebanon exists on the edge of a knife right now, and the ultimate spark that could tip the delicate balance here into a horrendous regional conflict, even worse than what we've seen so far in Gaza, could happen at nearly any time. And it's probably coming sooner than later. Watch out for this area of the world, and continue paying very close attention to it. Now, there's a lot of data that goes into producing these kinds of videos. Whether it's visually showing how much Lebanon's economy has struggled since 2019, detailing the geopolitical complexity on the ground around the Sheba Farms area, or showing the ranges of Hezbollah's missile arsenal, the ability to actually visualize raw data like this on the map instead of just reading about it in text format is exactly what makes learning about these kinds of complicated geopolitical subjects so fascinating to me. And it's why the Exploring Data Visually course is one of my favorite courses that I've ever taken with this video sponsor, Brilliant. They start out by teaching some real bare-bones fundamentals through interactive exercises and straightforward explanations. Then, as you progress, they bring these small concepts together into the bigger process. And soon enough, you have a decent grasp of what originally seemed like a daunting subject. And the same goes for all the other subjects they cover too, from calculus to AI to computer science, advanced physics, geometry, and much more. I think that Brilliant is perfect for the kind of person who genuinely loves understanding new things, as they get you to the level where you can apply the concepts you learn into your everyday life. And they also manage to make learning super practical. Their courses break down into short segments of only about 15 minutes, so you can easily use their app to make steady progress in learning while you're commuting or have some free time. So, if you're the type of person who loves learning new things, you can try out everything Brilliant has to offer for free for a full 30 days by clicking the button here on your screen right now, or by visiting brilliant.org/reallifelore, or by clicking the link down below in the description. And best of all, you'll also get 20% off of an annual premium subscription. It's an incredible way to help support my channel and learn some cool new things at the same time. And as always, thank you so much for watching.